Hi, this is Jody Apple with the Church of Christ in Dahlonega. Today is Sunday, August the 23rd. Usually, this message is presented during our period of worship on Sundays, but because of several things that are going on, it's being presented in a different time and in a different place. We had a guest speaker that spoke during our worship services this morning, but I still wanted to get the lesson that we had prepared as part of our Every Day with God series before you. Let me tell you what that's about. We started the very last Sunday of December reading through God's Word for 2020, but not just reading through it individually, at work, at home, wherever we might have been, but also using our time when we gather together on Sundays to review what we've read the prior week. So for Sunday mornings and Sunday evenings after our devotional, we have two classes, AM class, PM class, obviously, in which we're reviewing all of the material that we read the prior week. And then on Sunday mornings during our worship period, we are taking highlights, selected passages, text themes from our reading of the week before, and looking at those a little bit more in depth. Now, all of that material can be found online at the website that you see on the screen, thebible.net/EDWG. The letters EDWG stand for Every Day with God. And so here's where we are in our reading. We have been the last couple of weeks focusing on the book of Jeremiah. And this is the third in a series of lessons, and the final one, from Jeremiah and the book of Lamentations. 2 weeks ago, we spoke about this topic, Jeremiah. Why was he such an in-your-face prophet? And we noted that at God's direction, Jeremiah was literally in the face of the people that lived during his time in and around the city of Jerusalem and in the southern kingdom of Judah. He would speak to people as they go in and out of the gates of the city. He would speak to people as they go in and out of the temple. And he would confront them in an in-your-face manner with the message that God wanted them to hear, which was, you haven't been doing right, you need to do right, or God's going to punish you. And by this time, the punishment that had been settled because of Manasseh's sins was pretty much definite. It's about to come. Then in our lesson last week, we focused specifically on Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 34. And we called that Jeremiah Covenant 2.0, the ultimate update. In that passage cited in the book of Hebrews, Jeremiah spoke about a new covenant that God was going to make with his people, not according to the covenant that he made when they came out of the land of Egypt and came to Mount Sinai. It was going to be totally different. All of this material, by the way, is archived online at the site that we just mentioned, thebible.net/EDWG. Audio, video recordings, slides, the notes, everything that we're doing, it's all archived there. So let's get into the heart of what we want to study today, Lamentations. Assumed to have been written by Jeremiah, though we're not certain about that. So we're calling this lesson Lamentations, Crying for Judah and Jerusalem. The background of this particular slide is an ancient copy of the Old Testament text of the Book of Lamentations, found, if I'm not mistaken, in Syria in the 15th century. So let's see what Lamentations is all about. Lamentations, we're asking this major question, how could this happen? Well, what is this? And what happened? Well, let's look at the first 9 verses of the first chapter, and we'll get a feel for what's going on in the nation of Judah, in the city of Jerusalem, at the time of its destruction. Read with me, if you will. Verse 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she, who was great among the nations. The princess among the provinces has become a slave. Verse 2. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Continuing through verse 9, verse 3, Judah has gone into captivity. Under affliction and hard servitude, she dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. The roads to Zion mourn, because no one comes to the set feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted. And she is in bitterness. Verse 5, her adversaries have become the master, her enemies prosper. For the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture, that flee without strength before the pursuer. Verses 7 and 8. In the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the enemy. With no one to help her, the adversary saw her and mocked at her downfall. Jerusalem has sinned gravely. Therefore, she has become vile. All who honored her despise her because they have seen her nakedness. Yes, she sighs and turns away. And finally, verse 9, her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. She had no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy is exalted. Again, these are just the opening verses of the first of five chapters in the book of Lamentations. Let's ask this question repeatedly as we go through the text. How could this happen? Let's consider the style and the structure of the book of Lamentations, and then we'll get into the substance of it in just a moment. As we consider that, notice how it begins with the word how, or alas. What does that mean? Lamentations begins with language that reflects a death, a great loss, a funeral. The word how is used like that in the Old Testament to reflect a time of mourning, a dirge, if you will. It was used in the context of death, sometimes of nations and cities. We see that in the book of Isaiah, chapter 1, verse 21, and elsewhere in Jeremiah, chapter 48, verse 17. And so the question is not just a question about how did this happen, but it kind of forms the theme of what the book of Lamentations is about. It displays an incredible sense of grief, of horror, and disbelief. How? How could this happen? And the word alas is sometimes appended to the definition, means, you know, this is an incredible woe. This is devastating. How has this happened to us? What's the why? That term titles not only the book, the how, but it also tells us a major thing. How did all of this happen? How has God's will changed so dramatically toward us? Actually, God's will hasn't changed. It's our response to God's will that has changed. That's the problem of the nation of Judah and the city of Jerusalem. So that word how also informs us something about the structure of all five chapters of the book of Lamentations. That word begins with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. We are familiar with alpha from the Greek language, alpha, beta, and so forth. In Hebrew, it's aleph, bet. And so there's the Hebrew designation for the first letter. And what does that mean? Well, there's something unique going on. This word and this verse and this chapter starts a series of alphabetic acrostics. We're used to A to Z. That's 26 letters. That's not what we have in Hebrew. We have 22. So we have an alphabet going from the first letter of the alphabet in Hebrew to the last letter of the alphabet that kind of forms a mnemonic device of sorts for much of the book of Lamentations. So this first word, how, starts with that letter, aleph, the first letter in the Hebrew language. It starts that series of alphabetic acrostics that appears throughout the text. We want to focus on that for a moment. Again, centering on the style and the structure of the book of Lamentations. That word how forms some sort of outline about the structure. There's a pattern that we see in Psalm 119, for example. It's the longest chapter in the book of Psalms. It's the longest chapter in the Old Testament. It's the longest chapter in the Bible. There's a pattern there. The 22 Hebrew letters appear each time in a series of octets. What's an octet? Eight verses. So there are 22 groups of eight verses for a total of 176 verses. What's unique is every one of the lines in the group of those eight verses starts with the appropriate letter. And so the first letter, A, for example, will make it easy, is repeated eight times. And then it goes on to the next letter, all the way down through 22. So you have each of the verses in those groups of eight that repeat the letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now that's pretty thoroughgoing in Psalm 119. We don't see that exactly that way in the book of Lamentations, but we see something like that. We see four sets of acrostics that appear throughout the text, the first four chapters. And here's how they work. The first four chapters are acrostics, again, alphabetic acrostics. Chapters 1 and 2, each verse of three lines starts with the alpha letters. And then in order, that is, starting in the beginning and going through the end. Chapter 3 is like that, but rather than each verse starting with three lines, each line of the verses starts with the alpha letter. And then in the fourth chapter, each verse of two lines starts with the alpha letter. Chapter 5 happens to have the exact, that is, the right number of verses for the Hebrew alphabet, but it doesn't follow the acrostic form. Again, that's a stylistic thing that we see often in passages in the Old Testament, and of course we see it here. It helps things to be more memorable, makes things easier to follow. That may have been one of the reasons why it was presented that way. So I want us to review all five chapters very briefly. I encourage you to read it. They're not that long. You can read it probably in 10, 15, 20 minutes perhaps. So let's take a look at Lamentations and what's about. Lamentations, it's a sense of sorrow, a sense of woe is me, a sense of how could this happen, that alas thing that we see in the very first word, in the first verse. Lamentations makes Israel's state of affairs very personal. And we look at highlights from chapter 1. Look at the language, and we're not going to read the text. If you have your Bible in front of you, you might turn to the book of Lamentations in the first chapter and start reading as we're going through this. But it makes reference to a widow and a princess that is now a slave in the very first verse. She weeps, her tears, her cheeks, her lovers. None comfort her, her friends, her enemies. That's just through verse 2. There's an emphasis on the personalization of a woman who has lost everything, lost standing, lost purity, lost honor, lost dignity, lost all the things that she used to have. So the words she or her are used repeatedly to identify what's happening to her and what's happening to where she used to live. Her gates, her priests, her virgins, everything has changed. She is in bitterness. And it continues like that throughout the chapter. And so this imaginary woman is presented as a personification of what the nation of Israel has suffered. Israel as a her, Israel as a she, has gone through all of these things that brings her to a point of lament. Let's look at the second chapter. Lamentations in the second chapter explains why Israel was being punished. Now, the temptation is to think that it's the nation of Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar that's punishing them. And that's true physically. But they were allowed to do so by means of God's power, by means of what God allowed. So ultimately, it's the Lord's doing, chapter 2. Look at all these texts. Again, this is just some of the texts in the second chapter. It says, the Lord, his anger, he cast down, his footstool, his anger. That's just in verse 1 of chapter 2. The Lord, he has thrown down, his wrath. He has brought them down. He has profaned them. That is, he's changed them from being holy to common because they violated his will. They transgressed his commandments. He, God, has done violence to his tabernacle. He has destroyed his place of assembly. How did that happen? By means of the instrumentality of the nation of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar at this time. And so God's the one who's behind this. The Lord has caused these things to happen. Chapter 2, verse 6. The Lord has purposed to destroy. The Lord has stretched out a line. And that's just through verse 8 of chapter 2. As you continue reading through the chapter, you're going to see that in large measure, that chapter focuses on God is behind all of this. And so chapter 1 is about personal responsibility. She, her, all of these things have happened to her, the nation, because of their sins. But chapter 2 focuses on God as the reason why the sins that are mentioned in chapter 1, why they're going to be punished. Let's move on to the next chapter, chapter 3. Again, the theme of Lamentations going through a chapter at a time. Lamentations again makes Israel's condition very personal. It's personalized. And the assumption is, and we're going to talk about an option to that in just a moment, the assumption is that chapter 3 speaks about the things that have befallen the prophet. Assumedly, if Jeremiah is the author, which he is usually considered to be, assumedly through the person and through the experience of Jeremiah himself. So let's take a look at what's mentioned here. Notice the emphasis upon what this individual, as a man, as opposed to the woman in chapter 1, is experiencing. I am the man who has seen affliction. Verse 1, third chapter. He, God, has led me chapter 3, verse 2. He has turned his hand against me, verse 3. He has aged my flesh and broken my bones, besieged me, surrounded me. And that's literally what happened to the city of Jerusalem in the southern kingdom of Judah. They were besieged by the armies of the Babylonians. And so is the individual speaking about this referring to himself? Or is he using himself as the personification for the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Judah? Continuing, that was through verse 4 and 5. He has set me in dark places, verse 6. He has hedged me in, that is, he's fenced me in. I'm corralled, I'm surrounded, I can't get out. I'm trapped, is the thought there. I have become the ridicule of all my people. Again, that did happen to Jeremiah. He was pursued, he was persecuted, he was imprisoned because of the message that he delivered. But it also happened to the nation of Israel as a whole. That goes through verse 14. He has filled me with bitterness. He had a job to do that was the right job, but it embittered him from the standpoint of it was a tough pill to swallow because people didn't listen to him in large measure. But again, that could apply as this man representing the nation. He's made me drink something that's called wormwood, meaning that it's not good. It doesn't go down very well, so to speak. He has broken my teeth. Not a very pretty picture. He has covered me with ashes, a sense of mourning, of sackcloth, and so forth. So again, is this referring to the prophet specifically, or does this parallel another personification like we see in chapter 1, where the woman was personified as standing in for Israel? Here we see the man might be standing in for Israel. So Jeremiah, or the nation, the essence is still the same. Let's continue as we look at the theme of Lamentations. Now we go to chapter 4. The fourth chapter pictures just how far Israel had fallen. And when we speak of Israel at this time, we're speaking about the remaining element of the nation, that is the southern kingdom of Judah. The name Israel was used initially for the man Jacob when his name was changed after wrestling with the angel. You see that back in Genesis. And then it applies to his family. You have wrought folly in Israel, Genesis chapter 34. And then it became the national name. And so Jacob, Israel, same person, but now it's the nation. But Israel was divided during the time of Rehoboam, as a son of Solomon, and Israel identified as the northern kingdom and Judah as the southern kingdom. So sometimes as you're reading through the prophets, it'll use Israel, referring to the remaining element of Israel, in this case, the nation of Judah. So how far had Israel had fallen? The northern kingdom is already in captivity. The southern kingdom has just gone into captivity. How far did they go? Well, watch. All of this chapter talks about what they used to be, what they used to have, and now what they don't have anymore, what they are not anymore. Their gold has become dim. Well, how do you take the luster, the glow off of gold? Well, it can happen when you're speaking about things spiritually speaking. It's changed. The stones of the sanctuary, referring to the building blocks, the building stones that not only built the city, but specifically the temple, they're scattered. The temple was going to be destroyed in 586 BC. It wasn't going to be there anymore. It was destroyed. They would say, the temple, taking refuge in the existence of the temple, as if the existence of the temple itself, not the Lord who told them to build it, not the Lord who is said to have dwelt there between the cherubim above the Ark of the Covenant in the most holy place, they would act as if the temple, or they would speak as if the temple is going to save them. But now it's scattered. Look at this. The daughter of my people has become cruel. That's so antithetical to what God wanted them to be. God wanted them to be anything but cruel, to be kind, to be generous, to demonstrate loving kindness, mercy, and grace, characteristics of God in their own life to each other, as well as to the nations around them. Here's how dire things have become, especially during the time of the siege that was laid upon the city of Jerusalem. The infant thirsts. Children are asking for food, for bread, and nobody's able to provide. It's not that they don't want to, it's the resources aren't there. When you lay siege to a city, food supplies, the ability of getting everything you need to sustain yourself, even children, is diminished to the point that it's non-existent. And so nobody's providing for that. That's it in verse 4 of chapter 4. Look at what they used to have. They used to have delicacies. Every fancy thing that you could possibly imagine. Think about the rich man in the book of Luke. He had everything you could imagine, but now in torment, he's desolate. Here's the nation, had everything that God had benefited them and blessed them with, and now they're desolate. They don't have it. They used to dress in fine clothing and scarlet, but now they've got ash heaps. Totally reversal from what they used to have. Totally blessed, now the absence of all those blessings. Their punishment, as is described here, is greater than Sodom. Jesus referred oftentimes to the Jews of his day as being more wicked than Sodom was. He said, "Woe unto you, Chorazin, woe unto you, Bethsaida." If the same message that you are hearing now was delivered to those cities, they would have repented long ago. But that's not what's going on here. And so their sins are emphasized that much more because they should have known better. Those who are described as being the brightest from the standpoint of color in among the Nazarites, referring to their religious beliefs and their religious purity, they're not like that anymore. Now they're described as being like soot. They're described as being unrecognized. God says, in effect, I don't recognize you. That's not what I made you to be. The dead are better off. See that in the life of Jeremiah himself saying, "I wish I was never born." Repeatedly we see that in the life of Job. It would be better never to have been born or to have died than to suffer the indignities of being so far away from God, being estranged from God, having a broken relationship with God because you violated his will, his commandment, his covenant. So notice how dire things got. We noticed before that in verse 4, children were thirsty, children were hungry, and they weren't able to be provided for. Notice this, compassionate women boiled, cooked their own children simply to have food. That's an incredibly set of dire circumstances. The adversary, in this case, the nation of Babylon, under King Nebuchadnezzar, they've entered into the city of Jerusalem. They've conquered the city, going to destroy the city, going to destroy the temple. This is how far Israel had fallen, that God allowed these things to happen to his special people. Not special because they were special, because God used them as a means, as a tool, as a conduit, ultimately leading to the Messiah. And this is not all, we see more. But even the prophets and the priests were at fault. In other contexts, the princes, the leaders were also at fault. And so, how could this happen? You made it happen. This didn't just not happen out of the blue. It wasn't just coincidental. It wasn't just a set of circumstances. There was a cause. What was the cause? You didn't do what God wanted. And what's the effect? This. This is the effect. How could this happen? You, Judah. You, Jerusalem. You, princes and prophets and priests, you allowed this to happen. You made this happen. God, keeping his word with his covenant, is going to see that you're going to be punished. So let's go a little bit further. Continuing in the theme of the book of Lamentations, we went through the first four chapters. Let's look at chapter 5, the last chapter. Lamentations pictures in the end, the very end, the last four verses, and only briefly twice in those last four verses, a glimmer of hope. Now that's interesting. The book of Job is pretty dark, pretty gloomy, filled with lots of how could all this happen to a righteous man and so forth. Now, all this is happening, but not to a righteous nation, but to an unrighteous nation. But at the very end, the last few chapters, we see the story pulls out, and there's a positive, happy, live happily ever after ending, so to speak. In the book of Ecclesiastes, very, very negative. Everything is vanity. Everything is vanity. Vanity, vanity is all this vanity. Until you get to the last chapter, chapter 12, the closing verses, it pulls out at the very end. We see kind of that sort of thing going on in the book of Lamentations. Lots of problems. There's glimmers of hope and a little bit more glimmer as it ends in the last chapter, the last few verses. So most of the text of chapter 5 centers on the negative until those last four verses. So most of the fifth, most of the final chapter is negative. How is it negative? Kind of like what we saw in chapter 1 and in chapter 3 and then again in chapter 4. Chapter 2 is God's behind all of this. So three out of the first four chapters emphasize the negative. Chapter 2 emphasizes why this is happening to you. All the negative things in the other chapters is why God, finally, because of the sins of Manasseh, determined the southern kingdom is going to captivity. So look what he says. Everything that you have, the inheritance, it's given away to others. Strangers are going to inhabit it. Foreigners, aliens in this text, they have become orphans, they become waifs, they become widows, meaning that they don't have what they used to. They are now disenfranchised. They are now unlike what they used to be. Everything that God wanted them to have, they had, but now they don't have it. Now that they're in the land of captivity, they're not tilling their own land and producing their own crops and so forth. Now they have to pay for water. Now they have to pay for food. Everything costs them. When before, by God's grace, by God's mercy, physically and spiritually, God bountifully blessed them with everything that they needed, both physically and spiritually. So they're pursued in the land of captivity. They labor, but they don't have any rest. Their fathers sinned, and they continue that succession of sin, and we bear their iniquities. And so the consequences of the sins of their ancestors continued to this day. That's what's brought them to this place, verse 7. Servants, people, nations that we used to dominate now dominate us. Things have been totally changed, total role reversal going on here, and there's nobody that's going to deliver us, or so it seems. Right? We get food and at the risk of our lives. It's not easily produced. It's not as easy as what happened in the Garden of Eden when and Adam and Eve took care and tilled the garden and made sure that everything was just so. But now they're going to have to work, not just in their own land, but in another land under supervision by those who have enslaved them, who make them pay for everything, who make them labor. More about that coming when we see the young man. Notice their skin is hot as an oven. That's a pretty grim picture. And because of that, because of the fever or famine, we are suffering physically. And this is a representation of where they are spiritually. Our women were ravished. Not at all a pretty picture. Our princes were executed. They are described as hanging by their hands. And in other contexts, that's usually a sign either in the context of how they died, that is, they were hung, or after they were executed, their bodies were put on display. We see that when the Philistines killed King Saul and his son, Jonathan, and others, and put their bodies on display on the wall. It was a sign that we are dominant, we are superior, we defeated you, you are subjugated to us. So even the leaders who are supposed to be their defenders, they're not just less than dignified, humiliated, they're dead, they're executed. How grim can you get? Well, he's not done yet. Again, continuing the theme of the fifth chapter of the book of Lamentations, there's more negative coming. So, but there's still that very, very, very brief, slim glimmer of hope when you get to the end. So most of the chapter, again, is negative. The young men are not warriors. They're servants. They're grinding at millstones, very servile labor. They're carrying wood. They are enslaved to another people in their nation, not in their nation. There's no elders at the gate. Why? There's no gate. They're not at the city of Jerusalem. It's gone. They're not at the temple gates. It's gone. And so the elders don't have the place of wisdom and dignity that they had before. Again, they are held captive in another nation. There's no music from the young men. There's no reason for joy that exists anymore. Their joy has ended. Their dance is now turned into mourning. So total topsy-turvy situation, inside out, upside down and backwards. Everything is opposite the way it was. Blessings gone. In their place, they are cursed. In their place, they are punished. Their crown, as it were, not just the kings in Judah, but Israel itself pictured as if it were a crowned nation, is gone. It's not there anymore. They've fallen. They're broken. Woe to us. There's that sense of how, alas, woe. This is sad. We're filled with horror. We're grief-stricken. How could this happen to us? Still there. Most of the book of Lamentations continues that how, alas, woe, horror, grief-stricken sadness that you see open in the opening verses, even in the opening word. For we have sinned. That's exactly right. That's why all these things have happened. We have sinned. Because of this, all their sins and the consequences of their sins, our heart is faint and our eyes grow dim. Not that they can't see much anymore. Not that they're physically blinded, but they don't see a reason for hope beyond what they're experiencing, what's going on right in front of them. So there's that glimmer of hope at the very end that we mentioned. The last four verses in verse 19 is going to talk to us about God's greatness. God's consistent in comparison to their inconsistency. Now watch this. The nation is in captivity. They're going to be there for 70 years. Jeremiah, through as God's spokesman, is going to tell them that they're going to be delivered, that they're going to come back. So notice the reference here. You, O Lord, remain forever. Regardless of what happens to us, you are still God. Exactly right. Isaiah said that with reference to changing of kings, Isaiah 6:1 and following, but God's still on the throne. Same place, same God, same characteristics, same covenant-keeping God, same God who's always willing to love, to bless, to forgive, to show abundant grace and mercy to those who are willing to follow him. That's a constancy. Lord doesn't change. Malachi chapter 3 tells us that. Your throne, again, Isaiah chapter 6, from generation to generation. Our kings were puppet kings at the very end of the existence of Judah's reign. And they were led away. Zedekiah saw his sons dying, and he was blinded. Our kings aren't sitting on a throne anymore. In fact, as we saw earlier in Jeremiah, no kings will sit on the throne ever again. That's part of the consequences of their sin. The assumption is that what they're going through is what they're going to continue to go through. But again, there was a 70-year time period. It's not over yet, but it's not going to go on forever. God will restore them. But notice the question, God, why do you forget us? Why do you forget us forever? Now, just a reminder, God saw what the children of Israel were suffering when they were in bondage in the land of Egypt, and God remembered his covenant, of course. He never forgot his covenant. But for the sake of those who were reading and hearing this message during those days, they were reminded God had never forgotten his covenant. In fact, everything that's going on, everything that you see in front of you, everything that's going on providentially, everything that God has in his mind is working out what his covenant entailed, what it promised hundreds of years before, going back to Abraham and even back to the card Genesis chapter 3. Why do you forget us forever? That's the assumption that they're facing, that God's left them there for a long time. 70 years is a long time. It's not eternity. It's not 1,000 years. It's not 10,000 years. Yes, it was a few generations, two or three, during those days, but it wasn't permanent. It wasn't permanent. But watch the end. This is chapter 5, the last four verses, 19-20. Let's look at 21 and 22. Turn us back to you, God. Turn us back to you, O Lord. Now, that's interesting. It's not just that the people needed to change, which they needed to do, but it was depending on God to initiate, to extend an olive branch, so to speak, in hopes that they're going to return to him. God always wants people to return to him. God always initiates everything that he's doing on behalf of the nation of Israel. God's always starting that. Turn us back to you. Create within me a clean heart, a pure heart, is what the psalmist said. God, help us as a nation, not just as an individual, as a nation, and we will be restored. So one of the things that we have as we look at major Bible periods, epochs of history, we see a period of restoration that's going to take place after the end of the Babylonian captivity, after Cyrus's decree, the work of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, and so forth, is the period of time of restoration. God, you have to initiate that. You have to allow us to come back to you. You allowed us to be punished because we violated your will. When we acknowledge our sins, when we come back to you in penitence, you must save us, and they would be restored. That's exactly right. Look at this. Renew our days as of old. Can we go back to what we used to be? Can we go back to what we used to have? Yes, but not exactly. So Israel's never going to be the great nation that they used to be. There's never going to be a king sitting on the throne as there was before. There are lots of things that are restored, but not perfectly restored the way they wanted them to be. Again, remember, some of the things that they wanted initially and the things that they were engaged in initially showed a whole lot of self-reliance and not a lot of reliance, dependence on God. So turn us back to you, O Lord. We will be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us. Now, that's interesting. Did God ever utterly reject them? No. God gives up on us when we have already given up on God. That's everywhere in Scripture, especially Romans chapter 1. Why did God give them up to a reprobate heart? Because they'd already given up on God. It's not that they couldn't come back to God, but because they've given up on God and don't want to change, they've made the decision. They have sealed their fate in effect because they've gone against the will of God. And they knew better in that context, Romans chapter 1, or should have known better. Unless you've utterly rejected us and are very angry with us. Well, God had rejected them, but not utterly, not completely, not permanently, not eternally. And God was angry with them because they had violated his will. But notice that glimmer of hope. We can go back to you. We can be restored. Things can go back to the way they used to be, at least in part. So again, how could this happen? It's all Israel's sin. So before we get to this glimmer of hope in the last four verses, I want you to consider these passages, both of them from Deuteronomy chapter 28. This is after they left Sinai. Remember, they left Egypt, came to Sinai within the first couple of months. They're there for the duration of the first year into the start of the second. They're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. This is right before Moses dies and the great speeches that he gives, three of them great sermons in the book of Deuteronomy. And watch what he says. This is God speaking through Moses. It shall come to pass if, notice that contingency, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord. What? To observe carefully all of his commandments and his statutes which I command you today. If you fail to be my people by failing to do what I've asked you to do, which is not trying to earn your salvation, but to demonstrate trust and reliance and commitment and make yourself second place and me first place. If you don't demonstrate that in life, if you haven't demonstrated justice and humility and mercy in your life by submitting to me, then I'm going to pull back on these blessings. I'm going to withdraw them. I'm going to cast you out. Notice what he says. If you don't obey God's voice, if you don't keep my commandments and the statutes, which I'm commanding you now, and they never went away, the law that was being enforced by all the prophets, Isaiah before, Jeremiah now, they were enforcing, covenant enforcers. Keep the law that's been given to you almost 1,000 years before during the days of Jeremiah, 900 plus years or nearly that during the time of Isaiah. If you don't, then these curses are going to come upon you and they will overtake you. God is maintaining his integrity and being true to the covenant that he gave to Abraham, to Moses, and to the children of Israel now. God hasn't changed. They changed. Notice the next verse, also in the book of Deuteronomy. What did he promise? Again, notice the same chapter, later in chapter 28. If you don't do what I've asked you to do, verses 15, then watch what happens in verse 49 and 50. I'm going to bring a nation upon you. It happened to the northern kingdom. Assyria came against Israel. It happens to the southern kingdom. They've already experienced that. That's what Lamentations is about. I'm going to bring a nation against you from afar, usually described as coming from the north, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies. So the language here is going to show the surety and the powerfulness, the swiftness with which this is going to happen. A nation whose language you don't understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which, watch this, does not respect the elderly nor favor to the young. What's the point? They're going to kill the old and young alike. Again, notice the description in chapter 4 and chapter 5. Why has Israel fallen? Their sins. What are they going to be subject to? The ravages of their women and the humiliation of their elders and their young men and so forth. They don't show respect. Why? God's using them to punish you. So how could this happen? God said this would happen. God said this could happen if you're not faithful to me. And this is not just a message of Jeremiah. This is not just a message of Isaiah. This is a message going all the way back to the children's departure from the land of Egypt, traveling through the wilderness, and just about to go into the land. That's what we saw in that chapter in Deuteronomy chapter 28, the two readings. Now, watch this. This is Solomon at the dedication of the temple, the grand and glorious temple that by this time has been destroyed. And so David lives roughly 1000 BC, Solomon roughly the mid-900s or so, some rough dates here. And so at the dedication of the temple, watch what Solomon says. This is Solomon in his great prayer to God on the occasion of the dedication of the temple. What's he say? When your people, Israel, are defeated. Defeated? How can that be? God's going to take care of them. God's going to cause, a few men to put to flight, many, many more men. God's going to give them strength. The evil going to pursue from them. They're going to fly away from them, flee from them. How is it that they're going to be defeated? What's going to bring that about? It's because of their sin. That's what we see in the book of Lamentations. When your people are defeated, so it's a when this is going to happen, before an enemy, because they have, notice why they are defeated. Because they sinned. Why did they lose in the battle of Ai after winning the battle against Jericho? Because somebody sinned. Achan had sinned. And so they lost something, and lives were lost because somebody sinned. Nationally, that's going to be much greater as we get during the time of Isaiah and Jeremiah. When that happens, watch, when they turn back to you, let us come back to you is the plea in the closing verses of Lamentations. Make sure that this can happen. Well, it's already done deal. That's the nature of God keeping covenant from the beginning. You come back to me on my terms and the blessings will be restored. You will be like everything's new all over again. Notice, when they turn back to you and confess your name and pray, and look at this. So they've admitted their sins, they pray to God, they make supplication to you in this temple. Well, now they can't do that in the temple because it's gone. But the principle and the premise is such that even absent the physical temple, they can still beseech the God who dwelt in that temple when it did exist. They can still come before God. Then hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your people Israel. When they fall, when they have been defeated by an enemy, remember the promise that you made, that you will take them back. Yes, God doesn't forget his promise. Yes, God doesn't forget his covenant. He didn't forget the covenant with Abraham, Genesis chapter 12, mentioned in closing verses of Exodus chapter 2, and he's not forgetting it now. Notice what Solomon said hundreds of years before Isaiah and Jeremiah. Bring them back. Bring them back to the land which he gave to their fathers, which anticipates that they're not there anymore. So even in the context of Solomon's prayer, he says, there may be a time when a nation that's fierce is going to come upon us to destroy us, to punish us, to remove us from this place, Deuteronomy 28. Solomon anticipates that years later at the dedication of the temple. Bring them back when they repent. So let's consider some final thoughts about the Book of Lamentations. It's a negative book in large measure until you get to the end. But I want you to think about some other things. We've alluded to it before, especially in chapter 2. Judah and Jerusalem's real enemy was not Babylon. Ooh, that doesn't make a lick of sense. And Babylon's constantly said, even back in the days of Isaiah, that they're going to come against us. They're going to defeat us. They're going to take us away. They're going to bring us into captivity. They're going to conquer the city of Jerusalem. They're going to destroy the city of Jerusalem. They're going to tear down the temple. They're going to carry away all the riches of the temple and take them into a foreign land. Yep, that's true. Babylon's going to do that, but God was behind it. When you read through the second chapter, especially the first 10 verses, God is constantly depicted as if he is their enemy. God changed sides? Nope. Nope, God didn't change sides. Israel had moved. Israel had moved. You're in the wrong place. That's not where I put you. Spiritually speaking, you're not where you need to be. My hand's not shortened that I can't help you. It's you moved away from me. You have moved away from me, Isaiah chapter 59 in the opening verses. So God was their enemy. You might say, that's kind of scary. Yes, God allowed Babylon to punish Judah. He allowed Assyria to punish Israel. But God was the one who allowed it. God used Babylon to punish Judah, just like he used Assyria to punish the northern kingdom of Israel. It was God's doing. God had become their enemy, not because God was always opposed to them, but they had become opposed to God. It was their doing, not God's doing. It was God that they needed to fear, more so than any of the kings of the nations round about them. So it's not just Babylon's might that crushed the city and the kingdom. Physically, they were the tool. They were the instrument that God used. But it was God's wrath against them because of their sins against God that allowed God to, that gave God the right to the Babylonians to come against them. So God was the one who was behind it. They're the instrument. They're the agent. But God is the ultimate cause because they moved away. Look at this language in Matthew chapter 10. We're familiar with it when Jesus says it. But the principle that's brought out in Matthew chapter 10 applies here. Look at the language. Don't fear those who kill the body. The Babylonians could kill your body. We're afraid of them. Yeah, there's legitimate reason to be afraid in one sense, but there's a greater fear. The Assyrians can come against you and they can do horrible, horrible things. Just read the opening verses of Amos chapter 1 to see the wickedness and the ferocity of pagan nations when they went to war, ripping open the bellies of pregnant women, threshing people like they thresh crops. It's not a very pretty picture. Don't fear those people. Well, I'm afraid when I hear about that stuff. Yes, I've got that, but there's a greater fear. What is that? Rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell. That's not Babylon. That's not Assyria. That's not Egypt. That's not Philistia. That's not Moab. That's not Edom. That's not any other nation. That's only God. So when God became their enemy, because they had become an enemy to God, that's when all these things happened. So the final thoughts that I want us to consider here is they had gotten on the wrong side of not just Babylon, not just Assyria, not just Egypt, not just any other nation. They got on the wrong side of God. And that's not what you want to do. You don't want to get on the wrong side of God. Babylon could destroy the body. Babylon could defeat the nation. But Babylon could not kill souls. It's outside of their limits of their power. A lot of power. Very, very fierce nation. Conquering other nations, obviously. Conquered Egyptians before this at the Battle of Carchemish. But notice here, they couldn't kill the soul. But God could put you in that situation. Only God is going to be the one who's the ultimate cause to punish Judah and Jerusalem for their sins. Babylon was simply the tool. Babylon was simply the utensil. How could all of this happen? And God's so far away from God. They forgot who God was. They forgot what God wanted. And they weren't living up to that. Lamentations ends with hopes of. Notice, hopes of. but not the fulfillment of restoration in the closing verses that we noticed before. Historically, as we saw Jeremiah prophesying, we see it referenced in chapter 25, verses 11 and 12, and then again in chapter 29, verse 10. They were going to be in captivity for 70 years. It's a long period of time. Regardless of how old you're now, if you've committed some crime and you're going to jail for 70 years, likelihood is you're going to die in jail. And so, but the nation didn't die. You're not talking about one individual for 70 years. You're talking about the nation, and more people come in to the nation of Judah during the period of captivity. 70 years is a long time. Historically, yeah, that's tough. How are we going to have that happen and make it through on the other side? Restoration at that time, on the other side of the 70 years, didn't make everything perfect. Make us back the way things used to be of old was the plea. Lord, you can look upon us. You can make everything new again. You can restore us. You can allow us to come back to you. Yep, all of that's true. But notice everything when they did come back was different. It was changed. Same continuation of the nation. That was the same. It was not a whole new nation. The entire sea line of all the 12 tribes of Judah didn't end when they go into captivity. They continued. Different people in the generations continuing from them. Same nation continuing from the same seed line, the same people. But they're not the same anymore. There's not a king going to sit upon the throne anymore. Jeremiah talks about that, chapter 22 and following. In chapter 23, the weaknesses of the priests and the prophets. They don't have an army like they used to have. They don't have a temple when they first come back like they used to have. And when they did have a temple, it was a later temple, a lesser temple, not just a later temple. They don't have the standing before the nations that they used to have. There's no King David conquering as a warrior. There's no Solomon who's getting tribute from all the nations and expanding the borders of the land. They don't have that anymore. They're now a chastened nation, a beaten nation, hopefully a nation that has learned some lessons. But the greatest hope, an even greater hope than what they're experiencing now, is expressed in later prophets. We're not there yet. We're going to get there. But when we get into the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Zechariah, there are hopes anticipated there that are not just hopes, but promises and prophecies of restoration, especially in chapters 12, 13, and 14 of Zechariah, and in chapter 2 and chapter 7 of the book of Daniel. And those hopes, not just greater, but greatest, that are expressed there, all come through Christ. All comes through Christ, the very Son of God, who conquers all things physically and spiritually. He's going to rule over principalities and higher powers and so forth. But most importantly, he conquers sin because of who he was, the very Son of God, because of his suffering, because of his love, because of his mercy, because of his relationship with the Father, his willingness to honor and glorify the Father. He's going to conquer everything. Sin, rulers, worldly powers, all that spelled out in Colossians chapter 2, by the power of God that resurrects us when we are born again from the watery grave of baptism, when we die to self and sin, when we confess to Christ, when we're buried with Christ in death, in baptism, we rise to walk in newness of life. And all of that is anticipated in part in the writings of Jeremiah, especially the new covenant that we talked about before, and in the glimmer, not reality, the glimmer, the hope of restoration that's pictured in the closing verses of the book of Lamentations. It's going to be made real later. So if you only had Lamentations, you'd see, well, there's hope. There's a bright light at the end of the tunnel, but it hasn't been realized yet. But it is going to come. Lamentations is an incredibly powerful study, I think. And I hope you've been blessed by our very, very brief presentation of what we see. I hope this lesson has blessed you in some way. Just a reminder of what we mentioned before, all of these lessons are archived online at thebible.net/EDWG. So later this video, streaming live on Facebook now, later this video will be archived there. The slides that you've just seen, they'll also be archived there. An audio recording will be also there, as well as the material that we're going to present as we continue our Everyday with God study. In the book of Jeremiah, we're going to make it through chapter 50, if I'm not mistaken, in our review. Thanks for tuning in to be with us. Hope you can follow us again. Look for us at facebook.com/Delonica Church of Christ. And again, all the files archived at thebible.net/EDWG. Going to step out of the camera range for just a moment and stop the live stream. Thanks again for being with us.